welcome to another episode of Shelter in Place version of Hitchcast. Here we are again. We have a fantastic guest today, Lisa Hawk from Everlaw. Hello, Lisa.
Hey, Michael.
Thank you for joining us. Real quickly, before we go into Lisa's amazing background, just a bit about the event for those who haven't joined us before. We created this podcast series. There's just obviously a lot of chaos and we're in a troubling time. We just really hope to create an opportunity where we can all reconnect with leaders in the space, a very informative and casual conversations. There's a lot going on. And it's just nice to have two professionals chat about real and relevant topics that are important in the security and risk community. Just another opportunity for us to speak with some fascinating people and who we consider superheroes. So chance to hear their insights. Like we say, no hype, no sizzle, just substance. And that is our goal for these podcasts. So we hope you enjoy it. And welcome, Lisa. Thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
I was going to attempt to go through Lisa's bio here just to introduce her. She has a very interesting and diverse background. So if those who are not familiar with Lisa, Lisa's the VP of Security and Compliance at Everlaw. Everlaw is a pretty well-known, well-funded and well-known startup. Andreessen Horowitz and Menlo Ventures and the Google Venture Arms have all pitched in money. They are doing extremely well. Their customers are companies like large financial institutions and tech companies, government agencies, and law firms, and some journalists. And Lisa was the first security and privacy and compliance hire, and she's built out the program. She's hired a team. She's put the compliance frameworks in place for things like SOC 2, Type 2, working with FedRAMP. And it's been a really interesting story. And so what's interesting, as impressive about what she's done at Everlaw, I actually find what Lisa did before getting into technology and before being a head of security even just as fascinating, and something we want to go through today. But Lisa spent about 10 years in the energy space as a regulatory compliance advisor. Part of the time, she worked for a DOJ-appointed independent mentor monitorship, which resulted in a federal enforcement action for a little-known global accident in 2011 called Deepwater Horizon, which just knowing how Lisa approaches global issues is very impressive. And I'd love to dig into that with Lisa a little bit further. She's also a regular contributor on security and privacy and legal technology writing and to TechCrunch and Bloomberg and Wall Street and Legal Tech News. She was also admitted to the bar in New York and Massachusetts, and she is very involved in multiple philanthropy events and community events. One of them is one of my favorites, Women in Security and Privacy, and another as a board member in the Information Security Leadership Foundation. So all of this together with the fact that Lisa just moved from the Bay Area to New York. Wow, what timing. That is amazing. And in December or January, right? Right before the outbreak, if I'm not mistaken, right around the holidays. So there is no shortage of things we can talk about today with Lisa. And we just welcome you to the Hitchcast. Thank you so much for taking your time to do that. And I'd love to maybe start with how this interesting career trajectory and progression sort of played out. I wonder if you could walk us through that a bit. That would be great to hear from you.
Yeah, sure. Well, it sounds kind of crazy when you introduce me like that, but yeah. So I studied environmental science as an undergrad. So when I got out of college, my first job was actually as a bench chemist in an environmental lab. And if you've hung out with me, which I know you have, Michael, you know that I'm pretty clumsy. And after I was working in the lab for a certain amount of time, I decided that for my own sort of health and longevity, it would be better if I wasn't handling pollutants and chemicals on a daily basis. So I went to law school with the intention of becoming an environmental lawyer. And so after working in the lab and then going to law school, I went into energy regulatory work, which is how I ended up in the energy and oil and gas business for around 10 years. And during that time, I wasn't actually practicing law. I was embedded in the business. So first sitting on the commodity trading floor at BP with a natural gas and power business. And if you know anything about sort of physical commodity and derivative training, it's really technical. So, for example, you have to know how natural gas fractionation works and understand the physical products and then understand how gas is stored and transported, as well as market dynamics, geopolitics, and pricing for trading. And in compliance, which was my role, you also have to understand how trading platforms work so that you can give advice and, you know, problem solve in real time. And so people think software is complicated, but, you know, the energy business and trading is actually quite complicated as well. And so, in Everlaw, I lead the security and compliance team now, which covers security, risk management and compliance, privacy, IT, and currently legal.
That's great. And you may call yourself clumsy, but if I do recall our first meeting, I actually spilled my chai tea on my shirt. So
that's right.
takes one to know one, right?
Totally.
So, absolutely fascinating. And coming into a software world from derivatives, it must be interesting. It's very technical. But like you said, there's a level of complexity that you've been exposed to. Learn a little bit about WISP and ILSF and how are those going and what's your role there? I think those in the community, I think it's great that you're giving back to the community and contributing your time too. So I'd love to know a little bit more about that.
Yeah, so I think one of the things when you make a career transition, like I did from the energy industry into software and technology, one of the things, you know, you realize is that there are a lot of things that you don't know, and that building a network and community of folks that you can ask questions and, you know, get together with is really, really important. And so when I moved from Houston to the Bay Area back in 2016 to join Everlaw, I was seeking out, you know, a community really in the security and privacy space. And that is how I found WISP, which, like you said earlier, is Women in Security and Privacy. And WISP's mission is to advance women and underrepresented groups in the fields of security and privacy, which we do through things like practical and technical workshops, our mentorship program, leadership training. We have a job board, as well as conference and training scholarships. And just as a couple of examples, last year in 2019, we matched over 200 dual mentors and mentees, and we sent 92 folks to DEF CON on scholarships with their tickets and travel covered. And then the Information Security Leadership Foundation is something I came across sort of through WISP, actually. I became connected with a couple of folks at a conference who were big WISP supporters. And they said, hey, you know, have you met these other security folks? And that's how I found out about that group, which has been, you know, just great in terms of helping me on my journey through security leadership.
That's fantastic. I see it every day, the increase every day of knowledge around underrepresented candidates in security. It's really increasing from where we first started, which was really abysmal. And it's because of organizations like this. So I definitely encourage everyone out there, if you're not involved right now, please do get in touch with Lisa and some of the leaders there and be involved in that, because it's it really does make a huge difference. So thank you for doing that. And you have quite a bit going on, just the recent move, your work with Everlaw, your work with WISP and ILSF and other interests that you have. And what's your routine looking like these days? And you must be kind of exploding at the seams with activity.
Yeah, I think, you know, everybody is dealing with the challenges of various sort of, you know, shelter in place orders these days. As you mentioned, I moved to New York City at the end of last year for personal reasons. My husband got a great job here on the East Coast, so we relocated quite abruptly, actually. But so I've been working remotely for the past few months anyway. But my routine these days, I've taken up Animal Crossing, like everyone else on the planet, which actually says a lot because I'm not a gamer. So if I have picked up a video game, it says a lot about the fact that I can't leave my apartment. But other than that, you know, playing a little Animal Crossing in the morning while drinking coffee, and then, you know, jumping in to catch up with work, which being on the East Coast is pretty good because I have a head start from my team on the West Coast. So it gives me some time to catch up and dive into things. Then I'm basically on Zoom meetings for 5 or 6 hours straight, and then just trying to close things out before I eat dinner. What about you?
That's great. Yeah, I mean, I recall working in the East Coast as well, and it was always nice to go out for a run in the park or do something, which obviously we can't do right now. So right. I think it's great. Animal Crossing is a viable option. Congratulations on that. We'll have to talk about that offline and how you're doing in the games there. But no, that's great. I mean, the same thing. And we, you know, just trying to be, you know, part-time business owner, search person, dad, teacher, husband, you name it, friend. So it's a lot to ask, but we're getting there. And I think it's actually a pretty special time for us as well. So we all get to reconnect with people a lot deeper than we probably did previously. So good time for reflection. And speaking of reflecting, one of the expertise that Lisa has is in the area of business continuity planning. We have, in our conversations with other CISOs, we've seen a drastic change in CISO's involvement with their BCP and DR planning and execution. And recognizing that Lisa has a kind of a unique perspective in all security, privacy, and compliance. So we really kind of wanted to hone in on this super hot topic that seems to bring all together, all the aspects of a CISO's background and expertise together to build out and to execute on a BCP. It's really kind of a buffet of sorts for CISOs these days. But Lisa, I'm just curious, we've seen this massive increase in planning and executing. How has the sort of the COVID-19 pandemic affected the role, in your opinion, of a head of security or CISO in building and managing a BCP for a company? What's been your experience in your conversations and your own personal experience?
Well, for me, because I came from trading and then I came from the Deepwater Horizon response, I had a lot of familiarity with business continuity. Business continuity is a big deal in trading, especially in an area of the country with frequent hurricanes. So you have to be able to pick up and move. At BP, we tested our plans every year, which involved mobilizing our entire business continuity team to our backup site 3 hours away. So when I left BP and came to Everlaw, it was top of mind for me in terms of sort of, even though we were quite a small startup at the time, you know, how would we function if something happened to our office space? So if there was a fire in the building, or if, you know, if we couldn't access it for some reason. So at Everlaw, we've been doing BCP and DR, disaster recovery tabletops and functional exercises for several years. And then with the current pandemic and COVID, we've seen broader, just across the whole industry, the shift to remote working. So I think more and more CISOs who might not otherwise have been involved in business continuity planning, they just are now because of the situation.
Yeah, it's interesting that the kind of perspective of sustainability that you bring, coming from your background and from BP and coming into a technology startup, and the Silicon Valley is not known for their BCP planning, despite, you know, fires and earthquakes and other natural disasters. I don't think anyone kind of anticipated this coming, or at least those that did, we're a little bit more prepared. I think it's amazing to watch how people have caught up and really kind of honed in on this piece. I'm curious if you feel that, should and will companies kind of approach business continuity planning differently now that we have been all, everyone has this common piece. It's not as though an earthquake, affected us regionally, or a hurricane affected us regionally, or a terrorist attack, affected, but it's everyone in the world is going through the same thing for the most part. I'm just curious, do you feel that companies will approach things differently moving forward, and also how the CISO or head of security will be involved in that approach moving forward? I know that's a kind of a tough question, but I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I mean, my thoughts are that if you haven't already planned for mobile working and done tests, I think that is going to be a big aspect of BCP planning going forward, that companies of all shapes, sizes, and situations will we'll be looking to address, if not now, then soon. And from a security standpoint, I think heads of security will just need to be involved in that planning, especially when it comes to technology decisions, to be able to maintain the company's security posture, you know, aligned with their threat models and risk tolerance. So, for example, if you're a tech startup or you're shipping software and everyone on your team works on laptops and mobile phones, like it might not be too difficult to work out a plan for remote working. But there are a lot of companies where it's non-trivial. For example, if you have physical products or inventories, or, you know, you're an older company with landlines and fleets of desktops, and it takes a ton of planning. You know, my sister works in a hospital and in operations, and, you know, the first couple weeks of March, she was trying to figure out, you know, how do they forward their landlines to, you know, folks on her team's phones. So there's a lot of, there's a lot there.
That's amazing. Yeah. And there's a lot of logistics to think about here. And I hope we do get better at as a community. I mean, this might be a big wake up call for that as well. What do you think, as far as heads of security specifically, what's going to change on how they develop their plans? Because we're seeing a lot of heads of security and CISOs really taking charge of ECP, not just being involved in it, but really actually driving it. And I'm just curious, what you see is as changing in the way that they'll approach their own plans.
Well, I've seen a lot of sharing of approaches in the security community, which I think is really helpful. You know, in a situation like we are right now with COVID and the pandemic, the more information that leaders in the security field can share, the better. And I think there's also a big focus on aligning BCP plans to threat models. So, for example, heads of security are probably looking at the fact that when your company is operating in BCP mode, you may need to adopt technologies that you might not otherwise use, or, you know, tools or services that you don't normally rely on to run your business. So your security teams are having to help your companies mitigate these risks and work that into planning, you know, potentially doing exception management and, you know, educating your business partners about the risk of, you know, higher adoption of a tool that you don't normally use, or, you know, evaluating those security trade-offs.
Yep, I would agree. And we're seeing a lot of that. We're starting to see a lot of that as well in our conversations. I guess, what are some of the bigger surprises you're seeing in the security community specifically around business continuity planning? And it's great that they're all collaborating, but what are some of the big surprises that you're seeing, or have you seen any surprises yet?
Well, I think I just have, you know, a general observation, which isn't necessarily a surprise, but there are so many great resources on business continuity out there. I did a tweet about this a couple of weeks ago. So I don't think there are enough people taking advantage of all of the NIMS resources and training that's out there. And NIMS is the National Incident Management System, you know, especially startups. I think there's a lot of free training out there. There's a lot of resources to help companies build these BCP plans. So I think we don't need to reinvent the wheel so much, I guess, is what I'm saying.
I would agree with that 100%. And we actually see the parallel with NIST, with a lot of companies that we work with. Do not take advantage of the fact that there's an entire security, information security framework out there that they can look at. You know, some of them do, but the majority of them do not follow a framework until such time as someone introduces it to them. I think you're right. There are amazing resources out there that others have spent countless hours and efforts making sure that it is the right program with, you know, millions of hours of proof behind it. And so, we definitely should leverage that. And it's a good lesson for anything, but in this complex world of, you know, security and compliance and privacy, it might be nice to use someone else's education, pre-education before. Well, clearly the focus, for right now is that we all get through this as safely as possible, as healthy as we can, making sure that, healthcare and delivery workers and everyone, first responders are taken care of, so we don't overload that. But as we look towards towards recovery, I'm interested in your thoughts about what effects the pandemic will have on where the CISO or head of security's progression as an executive leader in these companies. And we're talking about BCP here, but there's a broader issue of how is this really going to change the perspective of companies looking at the CISO role, which is quickly emerging, if not already has been there as one of the lead technology executives in a company. So I'm curious your thoughts on that being in the business.
Yeah, I agree. And I think it's an opportunity for CISOs particularly to step up to the plate and lead their organizations through what is likely a really tough time, especially at smaller companies where there may not be a role already dedicated to business continuity. Because so many of the business impacts coming out of the current situation and the pandemic relate to security and privacy. So for example, you know, how can you operate your company securely with the remote workforce? How do you stand up secure remote working capabilities if you don't already have them? How do you execute on return to work when it's safe? So how will you protect employee privacy in the reality of what it might take to reopen your offices in a COVID world? So these are areas where security leaders can make a really big impact in their companies and strategically guide executive teams on how to navigate these challenges. And I think that's a big opportunity for CISOs.
I agree. Those are excellent points. I wouldn't have thought of a few of those, and that's great. Do you feel there's any kind of negatives or positives for the CISO community coming out of this? I mean, I think you just mentioned a few positives, but anything that that we should be aware of as a community to think of that could be a downside?
Well, I think, you know, the negative that's top of mind are that there are just so many people impacted by layoffs, or if they're not impacted themselves, you know, people they know and their families are impacted. And then also, just in general, I think the CISO and security community generally operates with a certain sort of level of stress because of the risks that they're managing on a day-to-day basis. And sort of the isolation or impacts of shelter in place can, you know, add to that stress. So I think everyone's feeling that. But on the positive side, and I like to be glass half full here, the issues that are raised by working during a pandemic and returning to work are just very relevant to security and privacy, like I mentioned a few minutes ago. So I think coming out of this, the CISO community will be even more valued and needed than before.
Yeah, all great points. And on the negatives, we certainly worry about that. It's one of the highest stressed positions out there in technology. I mean, it's why we created a whole company just to focus on this particular area, because they were being underrepresented and not really the narratives weren't really there to support CISOs. And of course, everyone being affected by out of work situations is really going to come out of this. We're already starting to see it the number of inquiries we've had, and you know, everyone wants to do their part in helping. But on the positive side, I mean, I agree with you. I mean, we really do need to see sort of an enlightening of what the CISO's role would be for many years. It was really just if you didn't know your CISO, kind of like if you didn't know your CIO, that was a good thing. Unless something broke, and that's when the only you knew about them. And I think that model really needs to change for the community. And I think this is the type of event that gets us closer. We're already starting to see an increase of CISOs on public boards as a want and a need. So I think we're going in the right direction. Let's just all make it through this, and we can hopefully reflect and move forward in a positive manner. Well, enough with the serious stuff. We have a little section in our segment in our episodes called Rapid Fire, sort of a lightning round of questions for Lisa to kind of throw her off a bit. She's still composed. So I'm going to go ahead and fire out a couple of questions to you, some personal, some business related. But first, since moving to New York, you didn't have a lot of time to be out exploring, but what's your favorite food or maybe your best find so far in New York City?
Oh, there's a pizza place called Keste on Bleecker. Love it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I know it. Yes, I know it. is excellent. Excellent. Yeah. And that's all said and done. It's a nice little pitch for them. So, how about kind of the food or thing you miss the most about probably both the Bay Area and Houston, since you spent a lot of time in both cities?
Well, I miss the food in Houston for sure. Houston is, you know, totally underrated when it comes to food. They have amazing food in Houston. In the Bay Area, I have family in the Bay Area, so I definitely miss them the most.
Ah, Yeah, it's hard. I've heard the same in Houston about the Houston food, by the way, and it's I'd like to get more time down there. What about a tradition, not Animal Crossing, but one tradition that you now you have to come up with something new. One tradition that you've adopted since you and your husband have been in shelter in place. I would love to hear. I always find it interesting to hear kind of the tradition or thing that you've done.
Well, since you knocked off Animal Crossing, it's going to have to be just eating at home. You know, pre-COVID pandemic, we eat out all the time. So eating at home is definitely a new tradition.
That's great. Yeah, in New York, you just don't eat at home as much. And, you know, it's like that in places like Tokyo and others. It's just, you know, you just go out. That's what you do. We've had a few here. The biggest, the most fun one we had recently was we put up our camping tent in the backyard so that the girls have an extra room to go play. It also duplicates as a classroom for me when I want to say, okay, we need a separate space to go actually teach something. So, but it's fun, right? This is, you know, in ways this is kind of fun. So in the beginning, frustrating, but now I think we're settling in. And now as we look at the recovery, what's the one place or thing you really want to go do once the shelter ban is lifted, once this is all behind us in New York? Obviously, we'll all still be cautious, but what's that one thing you've been wanting to go do or eat or see or anything?
I just want to go to any beer garden on a sunny day. That's it. I'll take anyone.
I love it. I love it. I love it. You can always make your own beer garden on your roof if you have access. So
I don't have access.
Oh, okay. Well, that's going to be tougher. on the business side, what's one interpersonal trait that you feel CISOs and heads of security need to have in order to be successful in this new world that we're in?
Well, I think grit. I mean, I think that you need grit anyway, but you know, in the current situation, you know, we need to think about the long game, you know, be able to persevere and sort of, you know, stay focused on the mission.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. I agree. And then what about the one thing that's actually holding most heads of security back from becoming that next level great CISO?
Well, I think, let's see, all the heads of security I know are great, of course, but more in general, I think just the ability to influence and then more importantly, ability to tailor your influencing skills is just really critical because security is about risk management and risk management requires change management. And you know, you can't win every battle. You can't make every change you want. And you need to be able to see the big picture and be able to prioritize what's most important to security. And then you also have to have the skills to convince leadership to support you, because without that support, you can't create a culture of security more broadly, which then is going to limit your ability to make needed changes. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. That's a great answer. And it's so true. I mean, we need to figure out the solution here. We have a lot of people that are very interested in CISO and heads of security backgrounds, and just it's great to hear your advice to them. And then finally, what would you tell your 2015 self? You know, here we are in 2020, supposed to be kind of a big celebratory, you know, multiple decades in the 2000s, but yet we didn't really get to celebrate the 2020 thing. That was kind of a big deal for me. And so, you know, reflecting on what it would have been like 5 years ago, if you could tell yourself something, what would you tell yourself in 2015?
Well, in 2015, I had such a different job. I was still working at BP, but I'd left the trading organization for the Gulf Coast Restoration Organization after the Deepwater Horizon accident. And so I was spending a lot of time in the States bordering the Gulf of Mexico working on getting environmental restoration projects funded, which I've been thinking about a lot, actually, yesterday and today, because yesterday was the 10-year anniversary of the Deepwater Horizon catastrophe. So I think if I were thinking back something to tell myself in 2015, I would say to enjoy it, because the fact is that was a once in a lifetime team and it was a once in a lifetime job. So it was tough, but I would tell myself to kind of savor it for that reason.
Excellent. That's great. You've made it through the lightning round unscathed. well, First of all, thank you for all your time, Lisa. This has been an absolute pleasure to get to know you and to have you tell your story to others. Thank you for all the work you're doing in the community with WISP and ILSF and everything else. And we just thank you for your time. So appreciate it. Any last comments or final thoughts out there for you?
No, I'd just like to say thanks for having me on. And if any of your listeners want to find me, you can find me on Twitter at LDHawk.
Excellent. Thanks, Lisa. Be well, stay well, and we will talk with you soon. Thanks again, and thank you for joining Hitchcast.